Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we're joined by the incredible Maiko Maven, Mia Maltz, PhD. As a UC President's postdoctoral fellow in the Division of Biomedical Science at UC Riverside, her research focuses on fungal communities and functional ecology in novel ecosystems, including pumice plains, drying lake beds, and the lung microbiome. Now, Mia studied at the University of California, Irvine, where she received her PhD in ecology and evolutionary biology, with an emphasis on ecological restoration and fungi. Her dissertation work in Kathleen Treseder's lab of fungi, ecosystems, and global change looked at the effects of habitat fragmentation and ecosystem degradation on fungal community composition and function. As an ecologist working at the interface of community ecology, biogeography, and mycology, her work broadly focuses on community responses to environmental perturbations, which feedback to then influence plant and fungal community structure and ecosystem functioning. I'm excited to learn about how these insights can help us maybe better protect our environment and our wondrous fungi. Mia, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Darren. It's great to be here.
Obviously, you've got a massive body of work, a really inspiring body of work, combining both this research in maintaining environments, but also community organizing and almost like activism, integrating all these things that, you know, when you think of intersectional environmentalism, are all already kind of interconnected.
Sure.
Your work's right at the heart of that. But before we dive into it all, I have to know how Mia got obsessed with fungi. Maybe that's part of the story of how you got obsessed with restoration of ecosystems, but how did you get where you are today?
It's interesting because I grew up on Eastern Long Island in New York, and I spent time in the forests in the Northeast and the tidal marshes by the Long Island Sound. And I always was impressed by how colorful and bright fungi were. They just drew me in. And my family, we grew organic food. And in the suburbs of the city of New York City, it was easy to see humans' impacts on the landscape. I was confronted by what a major issue environmental pollution is, and I was motivated to explore wildlands and appreciate the wild places, you know, and to find my path to help be a part of the solution or help ameliorate anthropogenic impacts. And I realized that this type of seeking and the search for meaningful existence is a privilege. You know, it still is. And, you know, I was fortunate to discover permaculture, which was incredibly inspiring for me, this design science that's in line with natural patterns. And it got me deeper in the garden and paid the bills as a permaculture consultant, but it was also my impetus to start teaching. And that really was a big deepening of connecting with the natural world and creating opportunities for people to also connect with plants and fungi.
I talk with a lot of people that are into permaculture, and I love that perspective. It's basically just trying to tie in with natural processes and natural systems. It's not necessarily doing something new. It's trying to learn what the ecosystem is supposed to be doing and enhance that. And I guess that kind of leads right into ecological restoration, right? In the best case scenario, it's trying to get the ecosystem to do what it's supposed to be doing naturally.
Yeah. And I loved fungi all through growing up. And I felt like on some level, when I found permaculture, that I was always looking for these intersections of fungi and permaculture and restoration. So I think in that way, I was looking for ways to incorporate mycelium into ecosystems and how to work with it. And from a young age, my dad really got me inspired by fungi. He had this old beat up paperback copy of a mushroom identification book. And he was the first person who introduced me to Paul Stamets when I was young. He and I went and took a course in the mid-90s from Paul on mushroom cultivation. So it was super exciting for me at that point to be able to, you know, learn about mushroom cultivation, learn about medicinal mushrooms. And this course I took with my dad was really transformative. And since then, I took pretty much every course that Paul Stamets had offered at that time. And I felt like growing small batches of saprotrophic fungi helped to demystify their life cycle. And, I was fortunate to be able to work in the field and get to participate with some of the Fungi Perfecti initiatives, the microforestry initiative on Cortez Island in 2004. And through trying to reconcile these interests in fungi and ecological restoration, in ameliorating the impacts of humans on the landscape, I wanted to learn more about biofiltration and bioremediation. So I started learning about the work of John Todd, and even took a course from their group at the Yestermore Institute in Vermont. And I really wanted to integrate these types of waste mitigation with fungi and fungal mycelium. So that was my hook. And partially because I got into this before the internet and social media bloom, I felt this urgency to represent the youth and represent the passion to connect this type of work together. And I had the opportunity to really travel the world through the mycelial lens. And I just was so bold. I went and I attended these international mycology conferences, even though I really had no business attending them. And I visited labs of prominent mycologists and joined their lab meetings. And I was eager to learn the language and the cutting edge of the mycological research, and got involved with local amateur societies like SOMA, the Sonoma Mycological Association. I know you've had a few guests on here that have talked about SOMA, but it was a really important piece in my mycological evolution, being a part of that organization, going to the SOMA camp and Bay Area mycologists, going and foraging with them and learning more about fungi and fungal identification, and being able to connect that piece with my interest already in ecological restoration.
When you have an early experience with someone like a Paul Stamets, I mean, I'm sure you can't help but then be pulled into the mycological universe and just become this huge evangelist. And then you really become this poster child, it sounds like. What I'm finding with a lot of influential people that I like is that they just started showing up and just being at mycological events and talking to mycological professors. And it's a little bit what I do on the podcast, which is people that I'm really inspired by. I just ask them to come on, and I'm always shocked with they want to come on and talk mushrooms, and you end up learning so much, and it definitely influences your trajectory. And it sounds like your journey was that kind of experience to a T. You were bold, you showed up, you were interested in mushrooms, and things just kind of fell into place for you to pursue that passion.
Absolutely. Yeah, I wasn't shy about reaching out to people if I found their work really interesting. And even, we didn't have Zoom. It wasn't like that. I was able to make it happen by going there. I went out to South Carolina and visited with Jan Kohlmeyer, who's a mycologist that wrote the book Marine Mycology. And I just was so interested in learning about marine and freshwater fungi for their potential for restoring aquatic ecosystems that, I'll go all the way there and go and look in the microscope with him and learn about what he's doing. And, traveled to Thailand and went to the International Marine and Freshwater Fungi Symposium. I mean, since then, I've been much more focused on soil fungi, especially since where I live in Southern California, water is a really limiting factor. And there's even much fewer fruiting fungi, mushrooms, than in other places where I've lived. But it still comes back in terms of water purification and working with fungal mycelium. My master's research bridged some of that in terms of the city of Santa Rosa had a wastewater treatment system where it was filtering wastewater through aquatic plants. And actually the city in Grayton as well, in Sonoma County, they did some really cutting edge work with their wastewater treatment facilitation there. I worked with Bob Rawson, who was part of that Grayton Community Service District. But my work with Santa Rosa, we had this opportunity to filter wastewater, and then I grew mushrooms on the plants that had filtered the wastewater and worked on using that myceliated substrate for remediating petroleum contamination. So there was just a whole integrated thing, looked at biofuels, biomass to biogas, and grew mushrooms on that substrate. I was really interested in closing these loops in industrial ecology and what are some of the byproducts of industrial processes? And then can we use fungal metabolic processes in a way to either reduce the size of the waste or the contaminants within the waste? So that was a really good opportunity for me to get involved with.
That's exceptional. And I think that's something that is what captures most people's imagination when you go beyond the medicinal, when you go beyond the food source and the foraging, which are all amazing and fun and lifetimes of learning on their own. And you get into this world of mushrooms as a remediator, you know, the world of micro-remediation. And it sounds like you were even going to that kind of the source, the industrial waste stream. And then when you talk about restoring environments, and like they do with so many things, mushrooms start to blur the lines between these.
And absolutely.
You know, you can't help but see it as all this one big integrated system. And I guess for me, not that it's too mystified, but there's always a bit of a mystery behind what exactly mushrooms' role are in bioremediation and how effective they are and how could they be implemented on, you know, a larger scale, which you're the perfect person to talk to about because that's exactly what you researched. So, you know, I've kind of laid out these different areas that it could come into play. But what are some of the central points you think where mushrooms and utilizing fungi and mycelium could be useful in protecting the environment and restoring environments?
Right. Well, when we think about ecological restoration, there's somehow this idyllic reference point that we're trying to restore a degraded landscape back to. And it could be a time point, maybe before a disturbance, or it could be a state of biodiverse, thriving, functional ecosystem that certain disturbances and human activity, development, and such may have then hindered those processes.
Right.
So when we think about ecological restoration and the grand time scale, really over geographic time or, you know, geologic time, we will eventually get back to a place where things will be diverse, they'll be thriving, as long as we don't keep having repeat offenses of disturbances. But I think fungi in particular really help to accelerate that trajectory. They help to promote plant diversity, like mycorrhizal fungi are incredible supporters of plants and plant growth and plant establishment, even in inhospitable environments. And decomposer fungi as the engines of nutrient cycling and helping to create the conditions conducive for life to thrive. And at first, I really wasn't so keen on pathogens. I really was coming from this place of like proselytizing the facilitative interactions of fungi with other organisms or with ecosystem health. But fungal pathogens also promote diversity in a way that they could limit monodominance in certain ways.
Right.
And they help, in a certain sense, homeostasis. So yeah, I feel like there's a number of really unusual ways that fungi could help support ecological resilience to disturbance and then regeneration post-disturbance.
Yeah, and I love that point about pathogens. I trend much down the same track where I want everyone to see the friendly fungi. And so I love that idea that pathogens are playing a role in the environment, even if, you know, our instinct is to wipe them out. You know, maybe that's not always such a good idea.
Right, right. I mean, they pose formidable threats, but they're there for a reason.
Right. Well, then I guess, what did your PhD work focus on? You know, what project in particular, how were you examining these concepts or principles when you got into a Kathleen Treseder's lab?
You know, Kathleen had a huge influence on me and my trajectory. And in one instance, she really helped me to get involved with land managers at large spatial scales. And we did a lot of big surveys, but even just in terms of my dissertation research, I got involved with land managers that were looking at different methods for restoring degraded land. And I did a large survey of how these methods for restoring degraded land and then how the disturbance that led to that degradation may have an effect on soil fungi. And I produced this meta-analysis in my dissertation, which looked at microbial inoculation in a range of disturbances, post-fire, mining, all sorts of different types of disturbances, and how microbial inoculation helped to promote plant revegetation, as well as the degree to which mycorrhizal fungi associated with these plants. So you would think it's actually quite simple that you add mycorrhizal fungi and there's more mycorrhizal fungi there. But in all of these degraded systems, it was really important for me to look deeply into it and see, like, what's the data? How does the data support that? And I looked at ectomycorrhizal, herbuscular mycorrhizal fungi, adding just mycorrhizal spores, so extracting those spores and adding the spores, or whole soil inoculum or commercial inoculum. And it was really interesting because after doing this meta-analysis, I conducted a number of experimental manipulations in the field with land managers, as well as greenhouse studies, and really found that complex mycorrhizal communities that encompass the whole soil, or a range of mycorrhizal species that were extracted from local soils that were like reference systems or undisturbed soils, right, that they were much more effective at promoting plant establishment and mycorrhizal colonization than commercial inoculum. So I feel like that had a big impact on how I move forward in my trajectory. And I started really thinking about how to look at surrounding landscapes that may emulate the characteristics of what I'm looking for and restoring a particular land to, and see if maybe the spores, the spore bank from that location could be used for promoting plant establishment and promoting some of these ecosystem functions that we want, especially to help the landscape to return to some more state of balance.
Intuitively, that seems like the way you would want that kind of thing to be done. I mean, intuitively, that makes so much sense, is you would want to take the closest environment that this disturbed environment should mirror and try to put into place all the foundational ecological systems that would make it go back to quote unquote normal. But I'm just surprised that this isn't more prevalent, or is it? You know, are these kind of strategies something that big land management groups, and this can be, you know, whether government or private groups, is this something they actually implement? Because I hope so.
Yeah, it is. But it's interesting when you start teasing apart the practices. So yes, but if you take a bunch of soil and you stockpile it and leave it for a long time, that may end up reducing the spore bank and making the spore bank less effective. So stockpiling the soil may not be, you know, all that effective. And then in terms of taking soil from one location and applying it to another location, if there were certain factors in the land that you were trying to restore, you would have certain ecological elements in play, like, well, maybe those that were there first would be more effective at promoting restoration. Or maybe it's that there are certain taxa that are redundant to ones that are at the site. So I think that, like, yes, it sounds really simple to be able to take some soil and either make a compost tea or take the whole soil and inoculate it in another site. But as everything, it's in restoration, it's context dependent. And maybe the moisture content of the soil, the time of year, or the vegetation community that's there would play a really big impact. And I was finding that it's a good thing to do surveys to see how rich the community is, even in the degraded site, because once there's kind of a critical threshold of mycorrhizal propagules there, it may not be beneficial to add more. Maybe you just need to work on revegetating with host plants and having a chance to promote those interactions in that way, as opposed to adding more mycorrhizal propagules.
So then, looking from this bigger picture of how to actually apply fungi to restore in disturbed environments, it sounds like there's a process of kind of initial survey, figure out what you got, what you're working with, which makes a lot of sense. So once you know what you have, And then you see, I guess, would you compare to the other nearby site in this example of trying to mirror a nearby healthy site? Would you try to see maybe what's missing and then add only that? You know, what does a little bit of that mechanism look like? And then how are you tracking to make sure that you're getting results?
Those are great questions. Considering fungi from a trait-based perspective is helpful because if there's something that you're trying to promote, a particular ecosystem function, maybe you're trying to promote more decomposition or prevent erosion so that the fungi can weave the landscape together, you may want to add certain taxa that can grow, like decomposers and others. In terms of mycorrhizal fungi, there are these three big functional groups within the arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi, the edaphophilic fungi, which go out and forage for nutrients and bring them back. There's the rhizophilic fungi that colonize the roots and they protect the host plant from pathogens. And then there's this ancestral arbuscular mycorrhizae, which we don't really know from a morphological perspective, because it's not that they're big colonizers of the roots or big extramatrical hyphae foragers, but it seems like they may promote drought stress, which in Southern California, that's a really important trait, a really important feature. So for me, in a couple of my studies, I've been able to show how when you add certain soil or certain AMF spores, it may be that there's a particular parameter in the landscape that you're trying to promote that would lead you to want to have more edaphophilic fungi or more ancestral fungi. And some of these large-scale global change manipulations have given us some of this information, because if you look at how like added nitrogen or less water or more water added in, then you can see how that changes the mycorrhizal community. So through being able to evaluate how these different drivers of global change affect the composition, even of just the mycorrhizal community, then you might start to think forward and forecast, well, what are some of the greater threats that this land should be confronted with in the future? And you can be more specific about which taxa you would may want to add in to help promote that ecosystem service or promote some certain function. And you were asking, like, how do you measure this? I do a lot of molecular work. I know that community ecology has really taken off because of these molecular techniques on a lot of levels. It used to be this real black box where you had soil or you had a soil core with roots, and it was really hard to figure out who was there. But certainly from the advent of Sanger sequencing, being able to identify individual taxa, up through this molecular revolution to be able to categorize whole soil microbiomes, we've gotten a lot better in being able to use some of these tools and bioinformatics to be able to characterize the community composition.
And what I'm struck by is how this is really a complex consideration of the ecosystem you're trying to restore. You know, at the heart of this is really trying to understand what the ecosystem not only has already, but what stressors are still going to impact it, even as you try to address whatever the specific disturbance in this instance is. And then obviously have an intimate knowledge of the fungal taxa at your disposal to figure out how you can add something in there that's going to do what you need it to do. And is diversity of, for just this mycorrhizal example, is a diversity of mycorrhizal fungi, is that pretty much universally the best? I mean, do we want more diversity? Is better for an environment generally?
You know, it's super interesting, these dynamics. So yes, I'm really pro diversity because there's a lot of redundancy in that community where you could lose some and still those functions will be performed by other species that are there. And that's a very permaculture sort of perspective, that many elements can support a single function. So like certainly having greater diversity, you're hedging your bets, especially if there's going to be inhospitable conditions that they're faced, where you may expect some species lost, at least cyclically or, you know, throughout the seasons. But there's also the generalists versus the specialists. So a lot of times there's generalist mycorrhizal fungi that will associate with a whole range of plant hosts. And then some of these others that are more specialized, they may have a little bit more fidelity, like a kind of a one-on-one relationship where they have a really specific host plant. And it's super interesting when you start looking at some of these dynamics with mycorrhizal fungi. Nancy Johnson, who's at NAU, has published a lot of really interesting work, like going back into the 90s. And Toby Kears out in Amsterdam has been doing a lot of really interesting work as well, which I highlighted in this course that I taught at Chapman University on plant and microbial communications, these underground currencies. Yeah. And it was super interesting to work with my students and consider how when you have certain conditions, like when it's really high nutrients, then it becomes less important to be someone that supports the nutrient acquisition of that plant. And then you end up having kind of cheaters where they get carbon from the plant, but they don't actually provide much for that plant. And then the ones that are the big givers and the big providers end up getting kind of blocked out. So then you get preferential allocation by the plant, where the plant will actually give its sugars, its photosynthates, to the fungus that is providing it with limiting micronutrients or something, and avoiding giving it to a fungus that might even be on the exact same root. So it's really an interesting and complex web in this hyphosphere.
Absolutely. It's kind of mind-bendingly complex, but that's interesting to think that plants are kind of mediating some of that diversity. So maybe if you add in redundancy, maybe plants will start making some of the choices for us, make our lives a little bit easier. And we're talking a lot about mycorrhizal. That's kind of where I think a lot of our imaginations go when we think about fungi that enhance and protect and sustain our environments. But do saprobic fungi fit into this as well? Do they have a role in this kind of larger scale disturbance restoration that we're talking about?
Absolutely. And white rot fungi really are my first love. I was so inspired about decomposer fungi and fungal decomposition of wood, Lynn Boddy's work in the UK and others, just really trying to get at these mechanisms for how fungi decompose wood, and then learning from that to apply that towards bioremediation and other types of applications. So in particular, with decomposer fungi, we find that their processes are really sensitive to global change. So there's linkages between their response to global warming and their ability to produce enzymes to biodegrade really difficult to degrade carbon compounds. So we think about the sensitivity, but then also there's this acceleration of growth rate where when it's warmer, saprotrophic fungi will grow much faster in a lot of ways. And when I think about using them for restoration, a lot of the work is on the erosion control piece, but mycorrhizal fungi play a big role in this as well. So different polymeric substances that are produced by mycorrhizal fungi and by saprotrophic fungi will glue the landscape together. So being able to combine saprotrophic fungi and mulching strategies, especially in areas where there is enough moisture to promote decomposer fungal growth, is a super important piece. And with some of my work with the nonprofit Co-Renewal, we've been working with saprotrophic fungi for post-fire biodegradation, biofiltration. So yeah, there's a number of ways that we could, and even with pathogens, I mean, I like to kind of bring it back to that as well, in that smut fungi have been a group that I've been working with to be able to evaluate whether they could be a biocontrol for these invasive annual winter grasses, the bromus of the bromus family, these smut fungi. They grow on brome grasses and they sort of sterilize them. They grow, and in where their seed would be is a sorus. It's kind of this black, smutty little fungal fruit body. And I've been working with looking at the temperature optimum, maximum, minimum, and considering how different features like pH may affect the transition from the yeast-like phase of the smut fungus into the dimorphic infectious hyphae, which then can infect the plant. So it's kind of interesting thinking about that, like in terms of that work. I think that the precautionary principle is incredibly important when thinking about biocontrol. And it's something that I more work on it in the lab and in really small settings to consider how the biogeography of this fungi is tracking the plants and the fidelity in terms of whether there's host specificity for these fungi, whether they would infect other native plants or other exotic plants in the area. And also implications for food security, because some of these fungi infect that are closely related to cereal grains. So you have to think about it from the precautionary principle. But I was fortunate to get involved with this project with Mike Allen and Edie Allen at UC Riverside. And they both have done so much work in the world of fungal ecology, bioremediation, fungi and mycorrhizal fungi and ecosystem functioning. And it was really fantastic to work with them before they retired on this smut fungi project. And I've sort of taken it over.
Wow. I'm kind of blown away by the people you've gotten to work and learn with. That's really amazing. And, you know, how much of a fine line are we treading with something like ecological restoration through manipulating different ecological players? You know, even if it seems like to me, inoculate every inch of soil on the planet with as much mycorrhizal fungi as possible, how could this be a bad thing? But do you have to have a careful hand with how much you're changing in ecology, even with these seemingly innocuous natural solutions?
Absolutely. I think that it's really controversial, because we think about how natural ecosystems may be resilient to disturbance, and then the butterfly effect of just adding any one little thing, how that may change the cascade of ecological interactions and responses. So I'm not a huge proponent of inoculate everything. Okay. I think that it is really important to do surveys, and I'm actually a huge proponent in the community being able to recover and regenerate. So biostimulation is something that you may want to do, where you can just add either substrates or food for the fungi that are already there. You could even take the soil that's in the site and survey it and evaluate who's there, and then bulk it up and add it back in. So I think that there are a lot of concerns with inoculation. And I think that the world of mycology, which is more looking at doing surveys of who's there and evaluating what responses of these communities to threats may actually be occurring, is probably fairly divided in terms of how much they would support any sort of inoculation to begin with. So a lot of the studies I've done have been observational and like real survey studies from deep soil to the surface to even airborne fungi. And using that information that you have, I think that for me, it's sort of, it doesn't take me all the way there. I really want to be able to take information from the survey and really think about it and consider how then you might want to use it for promoting the restoration of a particular landscape.
And at the same time, does the observation help you learn about how fungal communities are impacted by these disturbances? Because obviously you're getting there after the disturbance and just observing exactly what goes on. So how much do you learn about how fungal populations are affected by ecological disturbance?
Yeah, so that's a great point. So the world of community assembly, when you think about after a big disturbance, how does the community assemble? And that's when we start to think about those priority effects, you know, who's there, who are the pioneer species, how do the stress tolerators interact with the more competitive species to really create this community where you have membership. If you have a particular combination of traits, then you have membership in this community. So learning about observing and learning about the trajectory of how communities assemble is incredibly important. I'm fortunate to look at Mount St. Helens as an example of how after a huge volcanic eruption, what's happening to the community and how can you tweak things? And Mike Allen, who is one of my postdoc advisors, he did an experiment where they just released some gophers for a very short period of time from areas that were not part of the lava flow.
Right.
And the mycorrhizal propagules in the gut of the gopher and this very short period of time of the gophers being there, and like I'm talking hours, influence the trajectory of the community so much that even now, 40 years later after the eruption, the communities have maintained being incredibly different in the ones that had gophers or no gophers. So
the gopher
it's kind
effect.
Of that butterfly effect, right? I analyzed these communities this summer for the Ecological Society of America meeting, and we were supposed to do a big pulse up there at Mount St. Helens, but because of COVID, we delayed. Hopefully next year, we'll be able to do some more work on it. But yeah, you're asking about how observing is able to give us a sense of how the communities are responding to global change? Or was it a little more nuanced than that?
Well, that's the heart of it, really. But from ecological disturbance and then thinking, you know, bigger ecological disturbance like planet-wide change, how are we seeing fungal communities get impacted? With then the second part of that being, you know, how does this knowledge then maybe help us with finding tools, and maybe it's legislative, but some way to protect these communities? I think first we have to understand how they're being disturbed, right?
Right, absolutely. So this field of conservation mycology, of really having a sense of who's there without knowing who's there, how can we conserve what we don't understand?
Right.
Being able to do these surveys, being able to consider fungi and consider which fungi may be threatened before moving forward to do some sort of development or change the features of the landscape. One thing that ecologists have been looking at are these assisted migrations, where you start to forecast the future climate and consider how the future climate may be when you're restoring with a certain plant palette, whether plants are sensitive to warmer, drier conditions. You may revegetate with some more resilient plant species. And some of the work that has recently come out of University of Tennessee in Knoxville, Stephanie Kivlin's lab, has shown that mycorrhizal fungal propagules may not be able to keep pace with the plants, their host plants, without some sort of assisted migration, just mainly in terms of how they disperse. Arbuscular mycorrhizal spores are quite big, and it may be harder for them to disperse through the air. So in those cases, some of the assisted migration may include fungi.
So we're helping keep these communities together, just giving a little nudge to the fungi that have to keep pace with the plants as they flee environs that become inhospitable.
Yeah, and I would say that some of the more progressive or cutting edge environmental consulting companies or groups are thinking about these things in terms of resilience-based management. So adaptive management and resilience-based management. My nonprofit CoRenewal just put in a grant with Point Blue Conservation Science, and they have that particular focus to try to think about, okay, well, we're managing a lot of land in California and how to consider future climate, how to consider what conditions may be like when thinking about what plants or soils or practices are being conducted. And, you know, I'm hopeful that we'll be able to collaborate with that group to do some more post-fire biofiltration with fungi and take some of the results from my meta-analysis around inoculating with soil or inoculating with a single species of white rot fungi or a complex consortia of beneficial microbes and also comparing it with, you know, just thinking about what are people doing, right? Like, are they getting commercial inoculum? Are they trying to restore landscapes in a particular way? And how effective is that? Can the data right. keep pace with the practices? So I think that some of that work post-fire is incredibly important because there is really this critical mass now where people are looking to the fungi and they're coming to their city council, they're coming to some of the organizations and land managers that manage units, and they're wanting to implement these types of technologies. So how can we as scientists be able to design experiments and try to obtain the funding and the support to really keep pace with the practices that are being implemented? Because there may be some unintended consequences of these types of installations that we're not anticipating.
So we need to create this framework of actual scientific understanding to keep up with, especially I think of kind of community groups who want to start doing this work all over. We need to make sure we have that framework so they know what practices to implement and why they're doing it and how to prevent maybe some of those unintended consequences. And a big question I had too is, you know, aside from community groups and local mycology clubs who I know really are into these projects and want to find ways to implement these, so it's important we find ways that they can do that safely and have all kind of the tools they need, the knowledge they need. But are big institutions listening? I mean, is this something where big land managers, whether it's government or just big private management companies, is this something that's very much on their radar? Is we need to know how to deal with fungal populations? You know, as we're talking about all this, one can't help but think of Juliana Ferci's work with Fungi Foundation.
Really?
And how they're adding fungi into that new triumvirate of flora, fauna, fungi. I mean, are you seeing some of that reflected now in how groups are approaching land management?
A little bit. So I'm finding it more and more. But then again, I've been in Southern California now for 10 years. When I was up north in the Bay Area, there were groups here and there that were interested in doing it. Like the city of Point Reyes was interested in it. But I also felt a lot of resistance from larger groups and more conventional practices. Since I've been in Southern California, I've found that the land managers are really receptive to it. And it's surprising because there's so much fewer mushrooms. So it's like not really something that's in your face down here as it is on a forest walk, you know, in the winter up north. So thinking about how larger land management institutions are interested in it and maybe have the money to invest in some experiments and some projects. There's been a lot of academic land management interactions, collaborations since I've been in Southern California that I've been really fortunate to be involved with. And I just try to use the skills that I have to be able to generate data and design experiments to help support the work. But I still think we're pretty far away from it being highly widespread. For the most part, scaling up a lot of these technologies are challenging. Yesterday, this week, I'm at an International Soil Science Society of America conference, and we had a roundtable on fungi and contamination. So it's great to bring together a lot of big names and important people that care about this. And we had a conversation about scaling up and what are some of the challenges about that. And in terms of selective enrichment of media, growing either species or acclimating or acclimatizing whole communities to be able to grow with the compounds or the threats that are ideally to be addressed in the restoration. So thinking about this It really depends on whether you're focused on a single species approach or if you're taking a community ecology lens, because there's a lot of different approaches. And then we were just talking about the biostimulation, the bioaugmentation. So if you're augmenting with species or if you're stimulating the land to create the conditions for the species that are already there, those indigenous microbes, to be able to proliferate, there's different approaches that you may take, and the interactions of those environmental conditions and the species that you're trying to work with would really inform your approach. So I think there's still a lot of work to do to scale these things up.
And this idea of precautionary principles becomes that much more magnified when you talk about scaling up any kind of implementation to some massive size. What if you are changing that community in a way you didn't expect, and suddenly it's not irreversible when you're at a big enough scale.
Right. And sometimes the environment is just so inhospitable that you may add certain microbes in and they may perish because it's just the concentrations are so high, which you may find in some of these post-fire landscapes where there's been massive structure burns. Like CoRenewal has been working on that. And also in Ecuador, where we've been working in severely petroleum contaminated systems, it's really massive levels of environmental degradation. And then does a spoonful of soil really help in that case? Or are we really needing systemic change and larger scale instrumentation to be able to influence the magnitude of the effect?
Yeah, and prevent the future disturbance. Well, you've just invoked it a couple of times, and it's something I'm really excited to get into. What is CoRenewal? How did that project start? And then, outline a couple of the projects, maybe including one of the most famous projects, I think, which is the work there in Ecuador.
Well, I guess to back up a little bit, the organization CoRenewal became a nonprofit over 10 years ago, but we were functioning to conduct research in Ecuador to evaluate the impact of petroleum contamination on the ecosystem and how we may be able to work with fungi to biodegrade that pollution. And I got involved with that project because my dear friend, Kevin Cochen, who I had taught with before permaculture courses, he organized a festival, Symbiosis, then wanted to have a pre-festival permaculture course. So we organized it. I was one of the core facilitators of it. And one of our work traders, as it was from the UK. And she was a global activist and documentary filmmaker, Nicola Peel, who has the Eyes of Gaia, Nicola Peel. And she heard me give a presentation about fungi, and I talked about fungal metabolic processes, being able to see petroleum as a food source. And she had been documenting the impact of petroleum contamination on indigenous communities in Ecuador for years. And her most famous documentary is Blood of the Amazon on this topic. Mm. So she was a force to be reckoned with. She encouraged me to write a grant with her. We motivated, wrote a grant through National Geographic and did a lot of fundraising, and eventually were able to go to Ecuador and explore the fungi there and do some experiments, set up some research. And the work has continued on. We currently have a funding to look at fungi in a petroleum pollution gradient, funding from Metabolic Studio, which is this amazing environmental art studio based out of LA. And the work that we're doing there is in collaboration with the University of San Francisco at Quito, and some of the researchers there, Paulette Goyes and Antonio Leon, as well as in partnership with UDAPT, which is a union of affected community members from the oil pollution in Ecuador. And this is a representation, representatives of communities in Sucumbíos and Oriana provinces in Ecuador, where the communities have been dealing with a tremendous problem of surface petroleum contamination from oil exploration over the last 50 years. And it's been, a really interesting process for me working on the project, because in some ways, the science needs to be for the good of the Ecuadorian people. So any science that might feel like a contribution, let's look and see who's there, that is a very small piece of it. Mm. If you're able to identify who's there, are you able to work with those species and be able to develop best management practices for purifying water, for cleaning soil? So fortunately, there's been research that's being done through another organization, Amisacho. So I don't know if you're familiar with Lexi Gropper or any of her work. She started out as one of our students through the Amazon Micro-Renewal Project and Co-Renewal. And she went down to Ecuador and has been doing incredible work. She started this organization, Amisacho, and like an agro reforestry using mushrooms and working with communities and training young people how to do this work, local community members. And there's been a really beautiful legacy, I think, of this work. Yeah. And Co-Renewal, even though we still are working in Ecuador and keeping our partnerships and revitalizing old partnerships and really working to listen to what are the needs and protocols and practices that need to be employed for UDAPT, for the community members, our work is not just in Ecuador. We're also doing work a lot in California on post-fire ecosystems using fungi for biofiltration, as well as in collaboration with Danielle Stevenson, who has DIY fungi. She's amazing. And she's been working on fungi and metals, mycorrhizal fungi and heavy metals, and how that is impacting food and food security and the uptake of heavy metals. She's a soil chemist in environmental ecotoxicology at UC Riverside. So she and I get to overlap and work together in Co-Renewal, and then also, you know, other projects in Southern California, even though she's Canadian.
I mean, those implications of heavy metal uptake by mycorrhizal fungi affecting the plants they're connected to is a whole new perspective that shifts everything I know and believe about the impact of heavy metals and how important that is. You know, I know it's pretty common knowledge that yes, mushrooms uptake heavy metals, so don't eat mushrooms that are near an area that could have heavy metal contamination.
Right, the hyperaccumulation.
Is she saying then that it also then affects the plants, which makes intuitive sense? It would affect the plants that are attached to the fungi. Or do fungi have any kind of sequestration of heavy metals, which is kind of what I've always hoped, that they're somehow sequestering it and it's hyperaccumulating there and not traveling on?
Yeah. And I think it's still an area of open research, but right. acid digesting those mushrooms and being able to then be able to characterize what suites of elements, you know, metals or otherwise are being sequestered into the fruit body, and are the hyphae translocating it and such. But also thinking about the soil chemistry as something that may play an important role in the gatekeepers of whether these metals get into the plant root cells and into the vascular system or not. So there may be some interesting approaches to considering how we may be able to play a role in manipulating those interactions, and our practices indirectly may play a role in those interactions.
I've not heard of much research there, so I would imagine this is very much another example of needing tons of observation, situational observation, to see in all these different use cases what's going on so you can better understand what the mechanisms are.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Danielle Stevenson is also doing some of the heavy metal analysis on the post-fire biofiltration soils that Co-Renewal is implementing. And Maya Elson, who's the executive director of Co-Renewal, she's been really leading this effort in Santa Cruz in the CZU burn scar. But then Taylor Bright, who's up in the North Bay, and others, we're trying to have more of these replicated experiments that are along a latitudinal gradient, and we're looking at how context dependent it may be that this work is effective. So people have been using wattles or these long tubes of substrate along contour to be able to filter the water that's flowing post-fire or from any sort of polluting plume, and have been inoculating them maybe with oyster mushrooms or another fungus that can grow readily on straw or wood chips. But then thinking about this in terms of best practices, and can we harness the power of the indigenous microbial community to do some of this work? And if so, is that going to lead to the ecosystem functions that are most desirable, or is it promoting diversity and not necessarily leading towards the erosion control or keeping the pollutants out of the flowing waterways with, you know, sensitive species that depend on them?
I mean, there's so many multivariate things that can affect an experiment like this that you have to think about, where these smaller scale before you scale up, which my question kind of hinted at, I always want these things to scale up. How do we get this on a big scale? Let's put some money in this, see it at a big scale. But what you're really illustrating is how important it is to do these smaller scale studies and make sure we know exactly what the outcomes are, exactly what the mechanisms are, and exactly what we're trying to do. That's a big thing
they're
I'm taking away.
They're not trivial.
Too.
Yeah. You know, they're not trivial. And I know when you had Alan Rockefeller on, you guys talked about like counterculture labs and, you know, these right. different ways where we create more DIY analyses environments. So I'm really inspired about that type of thing, where in different communities that may not have as many resources, what can we use in lieu of a centrifuge? Like, can we just use a vise and a tube and, you know, be able to spin it with a screwdriver? So I'm just so curious about how to identify what are the analyses that need to be done. And then once we know what our protocols are and that's implemented at a larger scale in a decentralized way, then how could we then increase the capacity for there to be local hubs that could then do some of this work? You know, some, of course, you would want to ally with a university or possibly just have all of the soil sent to a certain location where the same analyses can be done, because you really want it to be comparable. So finding that balance between centralized power to analyze things that are exactly the same in the exact same methods, or having your protocols published and having people buy into it so we can do it in a decentralized way, the exact same way. So I think when we think about the science, it's really not trivial to have these decentralized experiments, but then the scale is larger, right? Like, I have some projects that are like throughout the entire Western Hemisphere or globally. And my survey in Southern California was like all throughout Southern California, like hundreds of sites. You have each one of those locations requires a lot of work to be done on those individual soil samples. So sometimes the decentralized approach could be really useful, especially if there's enough resources and things are accessible enough. And plant performance tests are a perfect example of that type of thing, where if you just have pots and soil and seeds and you're using the same plant species, you could then see if growing a plant in soil pre or post treatment would then lead you down a road to say, ah, the plant performance was higher post treatment. So then indirectly, that was one way of showing that the treatment was effective. But then you want to get also down to the nitty gritty, the chemistry, and the microbial community, which does require more instrumentation and money to be able to analyze.
And you're talking about a really powerful concept, which is this idea of decentralized standardization, where you have decentralized observation gathering, but then it's through a standardized protocol. I'm so glad you used the word protocol, because that's the word my mind was searching for earlier. That's what we're, that's what you're talking about, both in these big land management scenarios and with kind of these smaller experimental scenarios, is there's a protocol that you're starting to develop through your years of observation, partnered with other people's years of observation, as a protocol for how do we even start to approach these issues? And then, you know, both protocols and how do we approach the actual like real world use cases, like what CoRenewal is doing, it sounds like it's bringing this into the real world. And then how do we also implement protocols so people can do very small scale, almost kind of more academic or theoretical cases in talking about that process with these decentralized groups? I think you just elucidated many a mycophile's dream worldview of what we think is possible.
It is. Yeah. I had this, I've been fortunate to be involved with the Critical Zone Observatory Network. Now it's the CZEN, but CZCN used to be CZO, where we had many sites throughout the continental United States and Puerto Rico. And then everyone followed the same protocols, and you can install the same sensors in the soil and collect the soil in the same way. And once, you know, you can take a video of you doing it and then disseminate the video, and then people are doing it the exact same way.
It could be on TikTok even. Fantastic.
Right? Yeah, you can use some of these newer tools.
That's fantastic. And that really gets to the heart of the idea that we can all make an impact using bioremediation, whether that's through mushrooms or whether that's through any other agent, figuring out a way where we can develop those protocols and get everyone on board. You know, that's one way we can all kind of participate in that community science, that citizen science, whatever you want to call it.
That open source protocols, right?
Open source protocols. I think that's one of the biggest change-making potentials I see in the future.
Yeah, we got inspired about that, calling it maybe open spores.
Open spores.
Although I think I looked into it and someone was doing something with it. But yeah, that one of our collaborators, Allie, and I were talking about that. I think that would be a lot of fun to be able to have some protocols that then are open source, maybe published through protocols.io, which is something that I've been using. Then every step of the process is documented, you know, from seeds to sauce, right? Like all the way through down to how you might analyze it. If you set an experiment up in a certain way that has already thought about what statistics you might use, then you have some really nice plug and play ways that people can collect, whether it's baseline data, which is incredibly important, or post-experimental data.
Well, and then it's much easier for folks like yourself who are kind of bridging this community science to academic institution, gives you a powerful resource to then draw all that information into something like an academic institution that can then do some of the higher level, whether it be analysis or whether it just be interpretation of all that information that needs to happen.
Right.
I very much see that. And I think a lot of different folks in the academic sphere that I talk to get very excited about that. So I appreciate all the work you're doing and kind of helping develop those protocols. I mean, what are some resources maybe people can plug into if they're interested in what we're talking about? What are some resources people can plug into just to start kind of implementing this even at a local level?
You know, that's a really good question. I feel like it really depends on what it is that folks are trying to do. I mean, certainly with the post-fire work, that's something that we've been working on, connecting with communities from Southern Oregon all the way down to Southern California. And if you're wanting to set things up the same way and collect samples the same way, then we can analyze them the same way. But I feel like we're still a little bit far away from having all of the resources available. We're learning how to use certain tools and certain instrumentation to be able to collect the data that we need. But I definitely think that CoRenewal is interested in supporting some of these community projects. We have a collaboration with North Spore, which is a mushroom cultivation company, where we're going to be launching some student grants and to support some community projects. It doesn't have to be students, but, you know, just citizen projects or community projects. Also, the Mycological Society of America is a big one. When I was a grad student, I started the MSA student section, and that is going strong. And now I'm the chair of the Student Awards Committee. And I'm just so consistently impressed with student ideas. And there's more and more sort of bioremediation and applied projects that go on my desk for me to review, you know, to give awards to, and also their presentations, just incredible presentations. So I would say both at the local level, the amateur clubs, and the national level, Mycological Society of America has a lot of great resources, and the student section have been pooling together lots of educational resources for people who want to teach about fungi, as well as other things. Protocols IO has a lot of great open source stuff. GitHub has a ton of open source if you're trying to do different coding and analysis, and R being open source as a statistical program. So there's more and more available for you if you just start to let your fingers do the walking and make some connections. So much more so than when I was getting started, where I felt like I was doing all this detective work to figure out like what's even the language to describe what it is that I want to do, environmental microbiology, microbial ecology, and how does that all work with fungi? So there's a lot more now at our fingertips. And I think just being able to, rather than silo out, be able to connect with other groups that are doing this and see if we can come to some agreements where we'll do things the same way and it'll be a win-win because we can compare. And there may be some other piece there as far as like, well, why does this work in Oregon, but not in New Mexico? Like, oh, maybe it's something to do with the climate. Why is it working in this situation rather than this situation? Maybe it has to do with the nutrients in the soil. And you may get a lot of important information from those collaborations that may have been sort of unexpected.
Yeah, I think one lesson we can all take away just from your story is don't be afraid to reach out and connect, because that's a lot of the times where the magic happens. Do you see this as a huge future for the United States? And I guess what I mean about that is, you know, we are faced with massive problems when it comes to environmental degradation, obviously changing climate. And then there's this other kind of economic factor where the U.S. is kind of scrambling to figure out what our new industries are in light of a changing planet and changing technology that dictates a changing economy. Not to go too far down the economic track, but when you think about, you know, self-driving vehicles affecting those industries, you know, there's going to be a big shift. I think everyone sees it. Through increased automation, there's going to be a big shift. But green stems, and specifically this kind of work, this remediative work that has the potential to give a lot of meaningful jobs to people because there's a lot of land to fix. Do you see that kind of equation coalescing maybe in the next 20 or 30 years? Do you see this as a big future for the U.S.? Obviously, you're on the cutting edge of student boards of the Mycological Society of America, so you're in a better position than most to comment on something that big. But
I think so. I feel like with the shifts that are happening, as long as we're able to be receptive and listen and be thoughtful about the approaches, I am really hopeful that we'll be able to design systems, ecological systems that mimic natural systems, that we'll be able to use some of the patterns that we see in nature to reflect in the built environment, that we'll be able to have more of a sense of these industrial ecological applications and how to mitigate some of these waste streams before they're getting out into the ecosystem. So I think there's no shortage of waste streams. And for me, it used to be more like in terms of soil and water. And I've been thinking more and more about air and the airborne environment. And that goes really hand in hand with air pollution as well. So I think being creative and being able to really analyze what the problems are and going deep with it, having some critique of what's not quite working, and then not being afraid to get into the complexities of it. And then also being patient, because these things take a lot of time. And if you want the data to keep pace with the practices, then being okay with your contribution being a small incremental improvement. And it's really the cumulative effect of all of these incremental creative approaches that may get us closer to a society that's more grounded in ecological principles.
We can only hope that's the trajectory. Bringing back up that work you guys do in the Amazon, that's another important component too, is to make sure you're able to then integrate this work with the communities actually being affected. Because obviously in the Amazon there, you're dealing with people, you're on front line dealing with communities. And I have a feeling that would be much the same wherever you go, is the front line of some of the worst pollution is communities that maybe you have to be educated on the processes, and maybe, you know, there's cross-pollination and education that's going to need to happen there as well.
Absolutely. And I think that patience is really important with that too, because we need to decolonize our way of doing business and our way of interacting with others and being incredibly patient with others' processes, because maybe you feel like you have the next shiny great idea and you want to push it forward, but it has to be with the buy-in and the respect of the process and the consensus of the affected communities in order to really make any sort of systemic change. So I think that for me, being patient, really learning to slow down and be willing to do a little bit in a longer period of time that's done with everybody on board, as opposed to trying to do a whole lot, which then may leave people in groups feeling like they haven't been acknowledged or that their voice doesn't matter. So I really try to bring in environmental justice into the work that I do. I try to do a lot of pro bono work and grassroots organizing, and at the same time realize what I can do that's sustainable for myself, because I have a lot of value in wellness and being able to be in balance and grounded myself, and then how that will help my my work also be more tangible and deliberate.
Well, we've talked about kind of this massive body of work with Co-Renewal, the massive work you've done academically, helping, you know, inspire others and connect with others through the Mycological Society of America. My next question is going to be, but what's some of the other current work you're working on? But I mean, how would you even have time for more work? I mean, how can you possibly manage this incredible workload?
I will say that my work has really been directly influenced by what seems to be a pressing environmental issue of my time or in my community. And that's one of the reasons why it's moved in different ways. You know, I wasn't necessarily someone who really cared that much about invasive plants, but that was a really important issue in my community. And I developed my approach within it. So some of my current work now is looking at the drying lake bed of the Salton Sea and how that is creating so much dust and so much air pollution, and how it's affecting community members and specifically disproportionately affecting community members that may be poorer communities economically as opposed to affluent communities, and how the exposure to this air pollution is affecting their health, and how the Salton Sea is this main producer. So some of my work that I'm doing with these communities is trying to consider the effects of the pollutants and the fungi that are in the air on their lung and systemic health. So we got a big grant from the National Institute of Health to create a center for health disparities research. So the communities that are more affected, which includes a lot of indigenous communities in that area in Southern California, as compared to like Palm Desert and some of these other more affluent communities. So some of my work now in the medical school at UC Riverside is interacting with those features. And a lot of it is what's in the dust. So looking at the dust microbiome and then trying to evaluate whether some of the fungi or fungal pathogens that are in this dust maybe then having a disproportionate effect on people that are more susceptible to asthma or more susceptible. So how exposure then influences their health and their health outcomes. And some of my other work with airborne fungi, it's kind of a big part of my research program right now, is looking at the dispersal of fungi through the air and how environmental conditions in the source of where the dust is dispersing from, and then environmental conditions at the sink where it's dispersing to may interact, and looking at the air as this novel ecosystem where there's interaction and mixing between the source and the sink microbial communities.
We don't think of fungi in the air, but you're bringing this ecological restoration and examination of fungal populations, community ecology, to the novel environment that is the air. That is an incredible perspective.
Yeah, it's been an interesting transition. And I'm definitely been learning a lot, because what's one thing that's really cool is that microorganisms, some of them may be active in the air, actually having metabolic processes, ice nucleating, and using some of these labile or easy to degrade carbon compounds that are in clouds. So thinking about how there's sort of relic microbes that are there, or DNA, and then there's active members of the community. And then there's those that really can't take the commute, the inhospitable, harsh environment of the air would just lead for them to perish. So they wouldn't proliferate upon deposition. So I've been thinking a lot about that, sort of this unique airborne ecosystem recently.
In years, when some of this research is coming to fruition, I want to have another podcast talking all about this, maybe when I'm in a space where I can even process it. But that's incredible. I mean, the image that popped up in my head is this idea of like myceliated clouds, like active fungi feeding on the carbon and accessing water in the clouds. Who knows what's going on?
Right. Yeah, there's some that say that the diversity of microbes in the air rivals the diversity in the soil.
Okay, that's, I guess, you know, that old adage, as above, so below. So right. I guess that's still...
Yeah, I mean, yes, all the way out into the solar system.
Yeah, well, that's the next one, right? Fungi right. in space.
Astrobiology.
Pretty soon, Mia is going to be in an astronaut uniform, going out into space, examining fungal populations. Now, this really is incredible. Your body of work is vast, and it's hard for one interview to do it justice. So I hope we get to have you back on to focus, you know, as time allows, as research develops. That would be one of my great honors. But I'm sure, like many people who are like me that are listening, want to know, you know, how can I learn more about with Mia? How can I interact? How can I get involved? Where's the best place that people can find you and your work?
Yeah, so I am launching a new website, which is just my name, miamaltz.com. It's not up yet, but I do have a website through the university and through CoRenewal. You can find me, CoRenewal.org. Yeah, people want to reach out. I'm on Twitter, Mia Maltz on Twitter. I think Mycelium Mia on on Instagram. So if you want to find me, just Google me for my name, Mia Maltz, and I look forward to connecting with more folks in the future. It's been really great to get a chance to talk with you about some of our mutual interests.
You know, I did my reading and I thought I did my research prior to this conversation, but you were bringing out mind-blowing insight after mind-blowing insight. So there's definitely a lot for people to dig into just reading your university page and diving into all the work that you've done. Do you have any advice specifically for women who want to get more involved in the sciences, in these specific areas of science? Because obviously you're a very successful woman who was bold and showed up and got to have interactions with really like mushroom mentors all over the world. Do you have any advice for women who want to pursue whatever study of science, maybe specifically mycology?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting about that and thinking about women and collaborators, with the exception of my master's advisor, who's a man, Michael Cohen, I have worked with so many female mycologists. My organization, CoRenewal, is run and initiated almost entirely by women. My lab, my PhD lab, was my postdoc advisor was a female. My PhD lab was all women the whole time. So I have been exposed to a lot of really amazing female mycologists and researchers. And I certainly know that there's different ways that the research that women put out, sometimes it's not accepted in the same way as just like the data show that a male name might garner more respect than a female name. So it's like, I know that even though we think we've come so far and right. that equal rights for all, that different demographics, different gender or defying gender norms may lead to stereotype or various types of discrimination. But I would just say for women, be creative, tap into your creative potential and be bold, connect with researchers. Don't be afraid to reach out to someone whose paper you read. Don't be too wordy. Just get it out there that you're interested in it and that you could envision having some conversation about your mutual research interests and putting it out there and having the courage to really be a leader in your field. So I definitely would give that advice to young women to tap into your ability to generate potent and original scientific questions, and then to listen and learn about what the state is of that field, and then frame your intervention within that field, because there's so much still to uncover.
And it sounds like in this field of mycology, there is an incredible amount of female power. There are resources all over that can always be there to help you. And another big thing that I took away that I just wrote down was don't be afraid of your power. Because yes, that's something that it seems that I get the whole energy about you is like you're not afraid of your power. And just, yeah, examining, you know, what you're interested in, seeing how you can contribute, and being, you know, inserting yourself right in there.
Yeah. And I think also, don't be afraid of what you don't know, because that's where the most growth can occur.
Yes.
And being able to welcome that and invite that in, because we don't have to know everything. We don't have to be experts in everything. We can collaborate with many people that bring many different skill sets to the table. But yeah, don't be afraid of your power, and don't be afraid of that frontier of what you don't know.
And if there's one thing doing this has taught me, it's that experts love good questions. So there is a power in not knowing and then having a great question about it. And someone will probably want to share what they know and fill in that knowledge gap.
Yeah. As soon as you deny a beginner mind, you stop growing and stop learning. But for me, there was a really big transition between being someone that soaked up knowledge, who just had this thirst to learn all about fungi and fungal processes, to then being someone that was a contributor to the knowledge base. And I think that was a really rocky transition for me, because I just wanted to soak it up for so long. And then once I started to be a contributor, I realized how much responsibility comes with that. And it requires a lot of focus. And I really learned that a lot from my PhD advisor, Kathleen Treseder. She really encouraged me to focus and become that contributor of data, contributor, interpreter, and be a part of the knowledge base that then others can build on.
Yeah, that's an evolution we all have to go through, from being the student to the teacher. I really appreciate that insight as well. My other big lofty question is what you see the applied future of ecological renewal being. And I know we've kind of bitten around the edges of that throughout the whole conversation, but what do you see this field of ecological renewal becoming as someone who's on the front lines?
Yeah, well, I think that the more we know about the traits of certain fungi, the more we can work with them to implement them and learn from them and their power and what they have to offer. So I feel like the future is one where we've gathered so much information and we've been able to organize it in a way that then we can be incredibly strategic in how we integrate it in with future designs. So being able to be creative designers moving forward with the information that we need to be effective.
Well, I like that idea as designers. If you're going to be a good designer, you need all the different tools at your disposal, which the tools are the intimate knowledge of how these organisms work. And then you can start designing. I hear echoes of permaculture. It's all integrated. And I see you've kind of integrated in an amazing package. Well, Mia, I'm going to ask you some questions I like to ask all my guests. And sure. I'm going to modify the first one, as I do for many people who are into the diverse kingdom of fungi as you are. But what is a mushroom or fungal organism that you love and why?
Oh, well, there's so many. But one that I just tapped into recently is Phlebia centrifugia. It's a corticioid fungus that grows in the old growth forest, and it grows on the surface of wood, typically in these landscapes that have been left alone, even though I believe very much that management is incredibly important, but in forests that are like at this like edge of climax ecosystem, I think that the fungi that grow even as crusts on the bark of these trees that grow in this matrix protecting the land, that there's a lot that we can learn from that type of process and how their spores are released and what they may be doing.
We can learn something from every fungi out there. So I love that. Of course, I don't know at all what that fungi is. So I'm going to go look it up right after this. So thank you for that one. And then what has this relationship with fungi given to you? You know, just perspective, spiritual connection, purpose, whatever it is. You know, what has this big relationship with fungi given to you?
It has been so generous to me. I have gotten so much from a relationship with fungi. I think that the biggest piece is the awareness of the fungal processes, how it may transform its environment into itself and grow and be a transformer. And I think that for me, it's taught me a lot about how to be mutable, how to grow and continue to develop and be flexible with any sort of external stimulus that comes my way. And I think just learning about fungal processes have given me a whole new way to walk through the world.
I love that idea of transform it into you and move through it. That is fantastic. And I am really struck by how much taking on the fungal narratives or fungal perspectives can change in a really powerful way how we operate as humans. They have so much to teach us. And then finally, what is the lasting impact that you hope to make with this incredible body of work that's very much in process? You're still doing a tremendous amount of work. It's starting things all the time. But what's the lasting impact that you hope to make?
Well, I hope to emulate the properties of the person that I was looking for when I went out in the world trying to learn more about fungi. So having a thriving research program and a lab where we can explore environmental threats and learn from fungal processes, how we may address them through the mycelial lens, and to really be that person that holds that space for students and researchers to be able to move through their interests into a place of really implementing their visions.
Well, I certainly think you are an incredible facilitator and educator. You're very open and thorough and thoughtful with your communication, and at the same time, just have a very warm energy that makes us all want to sit and listen and learn more. So I definitely think you're very much having that impact on the world. Well, Mia, thank you for coming on the Mushroom Hour, sharing all of this information. I think this is going to, for many people, waterfall into hours of research now, like it will for me. But thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing with us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for the invitation. It's been really great to connect with you, and I look forward to following your work.